ago that the thing that we've been talking about and dreaming about all at once suddenly emerged as reality. And what we were talking about is free energy. A simple device that just sits there and runs and will produce all of the energy you can need for your home. And it's not a dream anymore. It is a reality. And I am so very glad to have in studio with me tonight three of the men who have been very, very instrumental in bringing that about, and another whose work has gone on for many years to bring that and other areas of a new kind of science to the fore. Tom Bearden, welcome to Open Mind tonight.
Nice to be here, Bill.
And along with you is Mr. John C. Bedini.
Welcome, Bill.
And Mr. Stephen Worth, who's sitting next to him.
Yes, Bill.
That's the nuts and bolts man over there, and Dr. Bob Beck.
Oh, Bill.
Very glad to have all of you aboard, and we want to have a freewheeling discussion tonight about science, I guess it is, about free energy. But, Tom, I think this thing of free energy has sparked the imagination of the KABC audience and the audience of our Let's Talk magazine. I had a little article about John Bedini in it. We had enormous responses to that. And I think, John, you did, too.
Yeah.
Over there. And certainly you, Tom, have electrified the Open Mind audience now for many, many years. You've been working with John. We've talked about it before. Is that free energy here?
It's here. It's for real, Bill.
What is that going to do to the way we live, to the way we work, to the way we govern ourselves, to world politics?
Well, we hope that it will indeed be something that will free an awful lot of mankind. If you look at our problems we have today, energy, the cost of energy, enters into the cost of everything we do, everything we make, everything that we have to pay a price to buy, to afford, the standard of living we're able to achieve. If we can have cheaper energy, we can certainly have a higher standard of living for everybody. If we can have very cheap energy that's easily portable, no matter where you are in the world, let's say into some far-flung third world country, where there aren't any roads and there aren't any railroads, back into the little villages way back in the hills, you can certainly better the life of everybody, even people like that. So it'll touch everybody's life if we can actually get this out and get cheap energy out to everybody. It'll increase everybody's quality of life throughout the world.
One of the things we often hear is they are not going to let you do that. They, who are they talking about? The power bases, the oil companies, or whatever. What do you feel about that? We've seen it happen in the past. We could have had free energy around the turn of the century. It was stopped then by the theys. What about now? What's going to stop that, stop them from stopping this from happening?
Well, of course, they're still around. This is a mysterious they. And they're certainly not taking too kindly to the fact that we're trying to get it out. There are at least four or five working model free energy devices in the United States today. I think, however, I'm very hopeful because I think we have a window that we've not had before. I think, you know, it seems that there have been, some 50 or 60 people in the United States alone over the last few decades who have actually stumbled onto or invented what we call free energy motors. None of them have been successful in getting it out, even if they had a motor that worked. I think we have a change that's occurred where we have a window that we can get it out. And I think the reason is that this day has made a serious mistake. Quite bluntly, they've loaned out a lot of money to third world countries and throughout the world, even communist countries, that can't even pay the interest on the loan, much less pay the loan. And they openly admit this now. And they openly admit to some $800 billion or so dollars that have been loaned out in that fashion. You know, you name your own figure. The blunt point of it is that money, or an awful lot of that's going to come out of the American taxpayer. And make no bones about it, we are going to pay that. You're not going to have any choice about that. Fine, but you cannot kill the goose that lays the golden egg. You have to at least feed the goose. It appears that they've got to give somewhere. And the simplest place to give is to allow a very cheap utility bill for the average family and for industries and so forth. This would free up an awful lot of money, which can then be taken on the taxes and so forth like that, and provide the money which can then be given to various and sundry international organizations and reloaned or given to the countries to pay the bills. So it's a kind of a distribution of capital, enforced distribution of capital procedure, but in so doing it, they're going to have to feed the goose. And in feeding the goose means, I think, that for the first time in the last 80 years, you will be able to provide means for cheap utilities and not get your head chopped off. At least that's the guys that are the sales that we're going on. And so we're trying very desperately to get out a device that will produce energy very cheaply for the home and later for power units that are bigger for factories and industries and so forth. In other words, we're shooting for the power that feeds utilities. You won't put the utility companies out of business. That's not the purpose. Not everybody would be able to afford a device like that, even if it were only $2,000 or $3,000. Not everybody could afford that. But if your utility bill were to drop to $10 or $15 a month, let us say, then the little old lady down the lane that's on the Social Security check could certainly afford to turn her heat up in the winter and not freeze like she's having to do now. And that's what we really want to do.
Are you finding any kind of resistance to this idea?
We're finding a lot of harassment, a lot of disbelief, of course, which we expected, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
That is not unexpected at all. And let me address the primary reason for the disbelief. There's an old adage about conservation of energy. Most people who use that term don't even know what energy is, as a matter of fact. So I want to be very precise tonight, and I know this is all going on tape. I know people will hear this in the future. And so I want to say some things that are very precise and rigorous. Now, rigorously, energy is defined as the power to do work. Work, rigorously, is defined as a single force moving against a resisting mass. Now, the key here is a single force. Not two, not three, not 500,000. One. Rigorously, if you have a system which uses multiple forces opposing each other so that they sum to zero, a zero vector resultant, you cannot apply the term energy to that system because the resultant force is zero and it doesn't exhibit any energy externally. But it can have enormous energy locked in on each little vector inside it that's making up the zero. Since I know some technical people are going to be listening to the tapes and to this broadcast, let me accent that a zero vector is not nothing. A zero vector is a system of other vectors which are continuing to act. They can be going bananas down inside the zero. And they can be deterministic. They don't have to be chaotic. So when you make a zero vector system, which nothing in electromagnetics out there teaches you to make, you have made a magic system indeed. If you know how to use that artificial zero, that zero vector, that artificial potential, you can warp space-time, bend space-time, which is just a potential in the first place. Now, to finish out the technical portion, and then I'll shut up so somebody else can talk. But I have to finish this idea while we've got it going. If I produce such an artificial potential, such a vector zero, the energy that's locked inside that is now no longer what we call energy. And we have changed the constitution of the vacuum across our system. We have bent space-time in the system. We are now not in special relativity at all. We're in general relativity. And if you will read your physics book, you will find that a general relativistic system, if you create one, does not conserve energy. And so what we're saying already exists in the physics book. If you believe general relativity. Now, if you don't, you ought to quit teaching it and you ought to throw the book away. So all that you do is you make an artificial potential, a zero vector system. You make a lot more of it in one part of the system than you got in the other. Everybody is supposed to know that a difference in potential creates a little river in a virtual state. And that is something you can tap and get energy from. And that's all we do. It's no more mysterious than having a river that nature is very kind to provide for you if you're clever enough to open the gate for the dam so that the river will flow. And then you put a paddle wheel in the river. That's all we're doing. It's just as simple as that. And you can do it. And it is perfectly permissible by the physics we already have in the textbook. It's just that they never taught you to make zeros.
Well, it seems like that along came a device that makes zeros. And we'll talk about that device in just a moment and the young man that put it together. I'm Bill Jenkins. It's Open Mind. It's past nine on a Saturday night. It's Open Mind, and we're talking about free energy. In studio with me is Mr. Tom Bearden, who has been on with us many, many times. John Bedini is here, Steve Wirth, and Dr. Bob Beck. We were talking about finding a system that would create this zero energy. It was found here not too long ago. Is that true?
That's true, and the young man that found it is sitting right to my right here, named John Bedini.
John, did you realize that you were doing all of that whenever you put together this little fascinating device of yours?
Yes. I want to kind of explain to the people out there how I did this. I was very curious about free energy, and also I was very curious about what Dr. Tesla's experiments were in the beginning. So I contacted the Tesla Book Company. And John Rasloff up there told me that there were some books out on free energy. Well, being a conventional trained guy all these years, I says, oh, well, that's poppycock. That can't be done. Because you can't ever get, you have to put so much work in to get so much work out. So what I did was I ordered these books. And three of those books kind of got me really going, and those were Thomas Bearden's books, especially in the electromagnetics and in the proofs of the free energy. And what I did was I set out upon a quest to, here was a man who sat there and he wrote all these books and he found all the errors, as far as I could see, because I really, from day one, basically never went along with what you call conventional engineering or conventional electronics. So here I sat all alone in my lab one night, and I had made a phone call to Tom the day before, and I said, Tom, is this exactly what you want to see reproduced in a motor? And he says, well, if you do that, then that motor should run. So I stayed with him on the phone for about an hour and a half to 2 hours. Of course, paying that great big phone bill.
We run up some real big ones.
But, oh, well over a couple hundred dollars a piece, but that's the price you have to pay for when you're in quest of something. So what I did was I reconstructed, not actually, there might be a better term for this. What I'd actually done was built what they called a pulse magneto. And I built a little oscillator that drove a motor in the form of a pulse. And what this did was pulse the motor for about one-third of its rotation. Then, on the second half, it was just like taking a lawnmower magneto, and I sent this back to the battery. However, after many, 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 many hours, I found out that I still didn't have any free energy, and the motor died. So I began to look at it a different way. I said to myself, you see, what I was looking for was the movement of electrons through the wire. In other words, what I was trying to measure was a current, something that every engineer wants to measure through this wire. If you don't have any current, you don't have any amps, that you would call it, and if you don't have the volts in the current, you don't have the watts. So therefore, I said to myself, wait a minute. What I'm dealing with here is something that's real special, and there's no current involved, because where you get the current is inside the battery after these two waves couple, so it's something you can't measure. So what I did was I tinkered around with this thing for maybe 15, 20 hours more, and all of a sudden I walked out of my lab one day, and I went out to do my general repairs, and I come back, and this darn thing was still running. I said, well, wait a minute. What's wrong here? What's going on? I said, that should have been dead hours ago. I didn't think anything about it. I just locked the door and left. But when I come back, this darn wheel was still turning, the motor was still going, and the battery was reading 13.5 volts, sometimes 14 volts. And I noticed that the battery was bubbling away as if it was in a discharge state. However, that was not the case because the meter was reading that the battery was full. So I stopped the machine, and I walked away for an hour. And I come back, and I measured that battery again because I figured, well, maybe it's just a disturbance on the digital meter that I had. So I walked away from this for about an hour, and I come back and I measured the battery again, and sure enough, I did everything I could do. I took light bulbs, I put them across the battery to see if the battery had the power in it or whether the meter was lying to me. Well, sure enough, the battery had the power in it, and when I reconnected the machine back up again, I started to notice the waves that were on this machine. And one very particular thing about this wave was that the speed made no difference at what the wheel was turning. The amplitude of this wave stayed the same no matter what speed until the darn wheel just quit flat dead. Well, after that I wore the bearings out in the machine. I made other tests. I never could get the machine, and this is a very truthful and honest statement, I never could get the machine back in time again. So I said to myself, well, this is much too critical for anybody to build. It's going to be a tough project. However, what I did do was prove out that Thomas Bearden's theories were absolutely correct. And so I wrote a little book about it, and I put down the waves which I had seen in this book. However, I started to search for machines and generators that had this effect of no drag when loaded. Well, you can go through every engineering book in the world and find yourself hours after hours, and every generator that you construct is going to have drag on it. Well, there was one in particular that I noticed. And so I constructed a very small model of this particular type of energizer. And I noticed that when I shorted this generator went faster. I did notice one strange, peculiar thing in the measurements, that if I put a 4-ohm load, and any engineer that's out there is going to agree with me, that if you have 30 volts of power, and you square that power and divide it by the load, that's going to be the watts that you have. So I did notice that with this particular generator, the lower the load impedance was, the less this generator would want to put out. Well, I said, okay, that's fine. That means that this generator could only be 36 watts at the power which I was putting across there at the time. However, I noticed something very strange. I put a 100 ohm resistor on there, or I put a 10,000 ohm resistor on there, and all of a sudden I had 500 watts or 600 watts. I said, well, this is absolutely backwards.
Well, the more load you had, the harder it worked, then.
Well, the more load I had in terms of low resistance, the less work the machine did and the faster it went forward. In other words, this is something that
backwards.
It's backwards. It's completely backwards machine. So I noticed one strange thing. That when this generator was connected through a bridge rectifier, and that rectifier was going to the battery, that the output from the generator, there was something that wasn't exactly right, and the performance of this generator was limited. So I started to do some very strange measurements. I found out, number one, on the first test that I made with this generator, that the generator had 100 volts of power across the rectifier at exactly 16 amps of power. Now, anybody in their right mind is going to calculate that out and tell you that that's 1.6 kilowatts, without a question of a doubt. However, the engineer measuring this said to me, John, you can't do that because number one, you're not using a full-wave bridge. I said, okay, here's a full-wave bridge. Let's do it again. He says, okay, I'm very tempted now, John, to subtract the battery voltage, which means that your generator is only 46 watts. So that's fine with me. However, I just want to clarify one point out here right now at this time. If that's true, and that's the true, accurate way that measurements are made, then everybody out there that drives a car should never turn on their headlights, because their alternators aren't capable of supplying that power back to the battery if the conventional measurements are right. Because if you subtract the battery voltage from the full-wave rectifier, then that means that you would have maybe 16 amps of power at 4 volts, and anybody can tell you that's not enough wattage to keep your headlights going. So that right there, that was a very strange measurement to me, and it led me to believe that this type of machine likes a half-wave rectifier more than it likes a full-wave rectifier, and it was without a question of a doubt, the battery was charging and bubbling faster with a half-wave rectifier than it was with a full-wave rectifier. Well, I did some more experiments on this, and I found out that these engineers and the people that wrote the textbooks have very conveniently did things to make things not last so long. And one of these things that I want to talk about is the rectifier, for example.
All right, I want you to talk about that in just a second. I want to take a little break here, John, as you're going on in developing something that is totally new. It works totally backwards. It works contrary to conventional electronics and understanding of it. And I think just now, as Tom did a little bit earlier, is trying to put that in focus in that all of the science actually is there. It's just never been tapped before, basically. Isn't that what you say?
It's scattered across about 4 different areas in science that haven't been well put together. For example, quantum mechanics and relativity, there is no proper consolidation of the two or union of the two yet in physics. The best attempt at that is called quantum field theory, and quite frankly, it hadn't cut the mustard yet.
Yeah. We're not going to be... We're trying to put all of this into language that Bill can understand, gang.
Well, in other words, what he has is a machine that if you try to measure inside the machine where there are different kinds of electricity from the kinds that we normally know, and I tried to get at that with the idea of what a zero vector really was.
Mm-hmm.
If you're moving that energy when it's locked inside a zero, the conventional instrument, if you had a good perfect zero, would measure zero current down the wire, and you could be moving enormous amounts of energy, but it's a different kind. It's locked in as a zero, and your instrument won't measure it.
So this is a whole new thing for the scientific community to think about. They better think about it,
yeah.
Because it's happening.
It's happening. David Baum's term for that is enfolded. It's been enfolded against itself, and so you'd say it's in a special kind of vacuum or whatever.
Well, it's going to be that kind of night on Open Mind. Science is going to have to take a new turn as a result of the work that all of you have done. We want to get into Steve Wirth and his contribution here in just a second. It's Open Mind on a Saturday night. I'm Bill Jenkins. You know, from all indications...
The guy has a sketch, and he visualizes this three-dimensional right away. I've never seen anybody in my whole life grind out arcs it requires $2,000-$3,000 worth of tooling just to do it.
Mm-hmm.
But I've seen Steve actually take nickel iron magnets and grind them to a perfect arc without shattering them. And it beats me, Bill. I mean, he's just an unusual guy. Usually when you take a magnet and you hit it against a flywheel, you know, it chips, it cracks, but not Steve's. Steve's came out perfect art. And I says, well, Steve, what's your secret for this? He says, I can't tell you everything, John. I'll help you do it, though. But no, Steve is a real exceptional guy in that he visualizes things without having the orthodox training. In other words, there is nothing clouding his imagination.
I know, I've listened to the two of you talk, and I've listened to the three of you talk, and it's amazing to see how you're tossing around the theories of Tesla and Moray and all the rest of them. So all of you, you know them. You're developing your own, and then you're putting it into hardware, in coming up with the devices. Steve, what did you think the first time you looked at John Bedini here and that gizmo in his laboratory?
Well, when I first seen it, I looked at it. I thought it was impossible for somebody to ever have free energy. So I looked at it, and I knew there was something unusual. It was different. You know, something about it I didn't know, but I knew it was different than anything I've seen before. So I got interested, and we started talking. So I says, why don't we make a bigger model? And John says, okay. He says, well, I said, don't worry. I says, I got the machines. We can make a bigger one.
We should say, Steve, you have a big machine shop there in the valley.
Right.
Okay.
So anyway, he's telling me how he'd like to have one made. And so we made a few sketches here and there. So that's where we went. Then I went back to the shop and made the little parts he needed. And we had to put some coil winding on some of them parts. And we did some experiments. And that's how we developed it up to a bigger point. Well, then the more I'd watch him, then I'd say, well, we ought to change this. And then we'd look at it and say, hey, yeah, it's a good idea. Stuff like that. Then we'd develop it to a better machine.
Well, we call these two the technobrats, Tom, by the way, because they sit there and think, hey, why don't we do this? And why don't we do that? The next thing you know, they've got arcs flying, electricity going, and wheels turning, and lights turning on and turning off, and they're not using any electricity at all. They're lighting up the whole world out there with their free energy device. Sitting to your left is Dr. Bob Beck, who's been deeply involved in scientific research of many, many different kinds. Bob, I know you've been out to see the Bedini device. In your estimation, are the technobrats doing it?
Well, one thing that absolutely amazed me was the day that Ed Skilling and I were out there, as John said, the amplitude of his output on the coils was totally independent of the rotational velocity, which is against the law.
Against the law, I mean.
Against the law.
Not supposed to do that.
And that captured my undivided attention. I've seen over the last 40 years dozens and dozens and dozens of these, and it looks like we finally have one that's going to work. There were so many flaws in the undershot, the T. Henry Moray, the Fuson. Mm-hmm. I've known many of these people personally, but it looks like it's here.
And it's doing some very strange and phenomenal things. I know the one that I have looked at, you hardly are using any kind of wire at all. It's number 30 wire to move your electricity. Well, that's smaller than a hair.
Yeah, a little bit bigger. It's about 10,000 in diameter if you put it on a micrometer, you know, use a micrometer.
But with that, you're lighting a 1,000-watt heater,
right.
A quartz heater. Now, ordinarily, a strand of wire that size would burn up instantly, wouldn't it, Bob?
Yeah, it should.
But it doesn't. Now, Tom Bearden, why doesn't it burn up?
Well, when it goes through that little wire is still internal to the circuitry. And if the machine were making a perfect zero, there would be an absolute, to the conventional instrument, there would be an absolute zero current going through that wire. What amount of current you do measure is the lack of perfection in the zero, because you can't make a completely perfect zero. You do have some spillage and some leakage. And so you measure a little current, but the most of the energy that's going there is in the locked-in form, and it's not, the wire doesn't think anything very much is going through it, because it's going through it in a different fashion, in a different form from what normally passes as current through it. Now, when this hits the coil on the other side, like in the case of the quartz, or when it hits the inner workings of the light, for example, the zero comes unglued. It spills out every which way, and all the pieces, all the little vectors that have been churning away in there like mad now are churning away independently and making real usable energy. And I might add that, you know, when we say we bend space-time, you bend it in one place up and it goes down in the other place. And so what the machine is really doing, the river that's being of energy that we're tapping, you'll find that the machine is taking energy from its surroundings. Otherwise, it gets pretty cold around a machine. And that's where the energy is coming from. In other words, overall in the universe, the energy is still conserved. It's in that local region that we're violating the conventional conservation of energy. But it's no more than the fact that, you know, we have a little river in that area and we're tapping the river.
Are you really violating the conventional conservation of energy, or are they just going to have to change the conventional?
They're going to have to change it, because the assumption now in the conservation of energy law is that your vacuum stays linear.
Mm-hmm.
You don't do anything to change space-time across the system you're using. That's a hidden assumption in the conservation of energy law. In general, in special relativity, you don't change the vacuum. In general relativity, you do. You have a curved space-time. And so, as is well known, in general relativity, energy is not conserved if you have such a system. And here we are deliberately making that kind of system. You know, we believe that, so we make it. So John's making that. It turns out all these crazy experimenters that were trying to do that, the Hooper coils, for example, and the Hooper patents, were a good example of a guy who understood to make zeros. He was bucking things against each other. He was making these zeros. And he got weird effects. And there's a whole history of people who didn't maybe put it in these kinds of words, but they were doing that. They stumbled around and tinkered around until they did that, and they got some results. And if we can make it very clear that the results are obtainable, they can be accomplished on a laboratory bench, and you can get energy. Nature has been very kind. The energy is there in an unusual form. So you've got to have an unusual approach to unlock the energy. And that's what John's machine is doing. And he's built several of them. He doesn't have just one. There are several
of them. No, every time you turn around, he's got a new one going.
Every time you turn around, he built them.
Tom, we heard the other day that someone had broken a patent loose in the patent office. Was that Joe Newman?
Yes. Let me say, you know, unequivocally, that Newman does have a device which will run itself and charge batteries. He does have a proof-of-principle device working there. He certainly demonstrated that to a substantial number of scientists who've gone down there and checked the machine and have signed affidavits that it does do exactly that. And they've run it long enough to ascertain that it's sufficient for proof-of-principle. Well, what happened was Joe has sued the patent office because the patent examiner before would not award a patent. In fact, they have not yet, in fact, awarded the patent. When he got to court, the judge said something like, well, I'm not an expert, but let's have a special master, they call it, a recognized expert in this area of energy devices and so forth that both sides could agree on, and then let the special master investigate this and come back and recommend to the court. Well, they did that. And the special master came back, and essentially he recommended, as Bob was pointing out, that there had been proof of principle shown, and that the previous patent commissioner was in fact biased, obviously biased, against this, and had revealed himself to be a biased examiner. And the special master advised the court that, you know, the patent ought to be issued and they ought to get a new examiner who was not biased.
I think he said to somebody, he says, I don't know how it works, but I do know that it is.
Well,
working.
He pointed out that it's not necessary to understand how it works. The law calls for demonstrating the principle. And then that's sufficient for a patent, even if you can't understand how it works, if you can demonstrate it does. So the situation it's apparently in right now is it has the judge sent it back to the patent office, following the recommendation of the special master, and told them essentially to get a new examiner who wasn't biased and look into this thing with a view towards issuing a patent. And I expect he'll be given a patent.
So we have free energy coming down the line, not only from John Bedini, but from Joe Newman. It's yet to be determined how much work the Newman device will do, other than proving that the principle works.
Well, he has certainly proved the principle. There's no question about that. His device does prove the principle.
So free energy is our subject, and if you'd like to get in on this conversation, you've got four men here who certainly know their way around it. You're getting quite an education. Your numbers are... Let's open up the phone lines to you guys. You ready to field them? Because there are a lot smarter ones out there than me to ask you questions, and there may be some skeptics who are not sure that you know what you're talking about, and hopefully they'll get in here, too, and put you on the hot seat if you're ready. All the numbers end in TALK, T-A-L-K, in Los Angeles, 520-TALK. In the San Fernando Valley, 990-TALK. If you're in Pasadena, Glendale, and Burbank, your number is 244-TALK. Out in the San Gabriel Valley, 448-TALK. South Bay, your 679-TALK. Long Beach, San Pedro, Downey, Linwood, Compton, that area, 639-TALK. If you're in Orange County, in the 714 or the 619 area code, 750-TALK. And if you're in the 213 area of Orange County, call us at 448-TALK. And talk to Tom Bearden, John Bedini, Steve Worth, or Dr. Bob Beck. You know, there's nothing to Bearden, John Bedini, Steve Worth, and Dr. Bob Beck. And on the line we have Ramon. Okay, Ramon, what's on your mind tonight?
Well, we're in the subject of free energy and the theories of Tesla, Tom Bearden, and Morey, and all the distinguished guests that are on your program tonight. I'd like to point out that this field, as it is now and will continue in the future, and it's probably been discovered in the past in ancient civilizations is probably more likely to affect human mind than any mechanical system or invention as far as generating electricity. The simple fact is that it's inner space that we're tapping. And, of course, the mind is part of that domain. Now, I would like to ask a question to Dr. Bob Beck and then Tom Bearden. First of all, Dr. Beck, you recently released the theory of Dr. Tesla on his death ray using minute particles. And you pointed out that it had nothing to do with his transmission of electrical power. And, of course, Tom Bearden has come up with the theory that scalar waves were, in fact, discovered by Tesla, and that both of these systems are different, yet they're the same. I have a case in point. In the words of Tesla, he did invent the death ray as a particle. Then later on he said that he superseded the original invention and had a new working system, which could explain the scalar device. Now, maybe there's some more information that my two colleagues have can share with the audience concerning this.
Okay, Ramon, it was a rather incredible story. Back shortly after his death, a chap who was in charge of FDR's Buck Rogers squad, he was a Canadian citizen who had an IQ up around 200, realized that Tesla's effects were going offshore, where FDR's friend Stalin could pick them up by way of Yugoslavia. And he had the good sense to microfilm a number of the Tesla papers, which had never seen the light of day until the psychotronics conference this year, when I decided to go ahead and release this material. He left these papers with me in trust about 25 years ago. And so we showed this device, which was basically a very high voltage electrostatic generator, as only Tesla could build of this quality, and it was basically the forerunner of the particle beam weaponry. Now, in the later years of Tesla's life, he, each year at his birthday, would have to announce a bigger and better invention. Many of these, we believe, may have been fabrications. Many of them were not. And as far as I know, having had the microfilms of most of the material that was shipped to Yugoslavia, including the parts that were never made public, I don't think that he approached the death ray with any other technology except this highly accelerated particle beam weaponry system. Ramon, I know you're quite an expert in these fields and psychotronics. Did you have a different viewpoint on that?
Yes, sir. In fact, in the early part of this beginning of Tesla's death idea, the idea actually came about because he was standing in front of his discharge tubes, and he had lime being disintegrated. Of course, it penetrated the glass, and it would shock you. But that was basically his particle beam weaponized. Later on, he was fortunate enough to attend a conference where notable scientists were speaking, and had the theory of electrical sound waves. Now, he had a discharge battery storage cell, and this French scientist had a short wire and thick bicross dimension, and the other pole of the terminal. When he touched this, he created an arc. He would produce a wind, a small, minute particle that can penetrate materials. Now, this means it could even penetrate steel sheeting, which later on Tesla discovered as a way that traveled exceeding that of light. This also brings to mind the Navy and their underwater submarines. They use huge storage batteries, and they have carbon discharges. So they have a breaker system that uses carbon and copper electrodes. When these are flipped, let's say a power surge, they have actually seen ball lightning coming out of the end. Tesla's been known to have created these. So I think Tom is correct in the assumption that Tesla did indeed discover non-Hertzian waves, and that they do exceed the speed of light. And it's based on later work that he did.
I think that's correct. I sort of resurrected John Rogers' work and Hooper's work.
As a matter of fact, Vic is the one who furnished the Rogers work to me. That's where I got the original source for James Harris Rogers' work, for the Rogers Undersea and Underwater Transmission System.
Whatever happened to that?
Let Beck tell you.
It's another one of these things that seem to vanish off the face of the earth. Ramon, what he basically did was turn a field inside out. He would shift the shield for the center conductor on what would be the equivalent of a coax cable today. When you do this, it generates some extremely interesting phenomena. There's a little bit left over, and I think this is what Tom has called to our attention as being the scalar domain. We've built some little instruments to demonstrate this, and as you probably realize, it's impossible to shield this energy with ordinary technology, either Faraday shields or magnetic shields or what have you. And I've built and demonstrated some little devices, which I think most of you have seen. Let Tom address this. Tom is really up to speed on the mathematics of scalar technology and communication.
Well, Raymond, it's nice to talk to you again. I hope to see you here very shortly. I'm going to tell the audience that Raymond has done some very interesting experiments of his own. I'm not going to discuss them unless he wants to discuss them himself.
I had a feeling that Ramon knew you guys.
Super guy.
We all know Ramon. He's really done his homework.
Tesla definitely had a particle beam type weapon. He also definitely had a long involvement with transmission of energy at a distance without loss and without wires, as he so frequently said. When he said without loss, he meant 95% efficiency, 98%, something like that. He was adamant in his opposition to Hertz wave theory. He even visited Heinrich Hertz to convince him of the error of his ways, and he left there very disturbed that Hertz could not see that there could not exist such a thing as a transverse force wave in vacuum. In fact, a lot of the stuff that I've done on scalar waves started with the fact that here's a man that gave us AC electricity, he gave us the motors and generators we use, and he adamantly said there is no such thing as a Hertz wave. Well, how could, you know, these two didn't jive. So if you looked at it deep enough, you begin to see that Tesla had an awful lot of things going for him when he said you can't have a Hertz wave in vacuum. I've come to believe you cannot have such a thing. Now, I definitely believe you get a Hertz wave in the receiving antenna in the electron gas. And you have one in the transmitting antenna in the electron gas, but you don't have one in the vacuum in between. And I think that can be proven today with what we know today. But we've never gone back and re-examined the fundamentals of electromagnetics, that the basic concepts that we set out 100 years ago or so. They've just been accepted without question and passed along. And I think it's high time that all of those fundamentals got re-examined. And that's what I've been doing in a crude way. Now, when you do that, you get at something that comes out...
I wouldn't call your booklet crude.
Well, what you find is that the bits and pieces of that today do exist in physics. For example, I quoted the Baum-Aronoff paper in 1959, and there have been a series of experiments done to show that the Baum-Aronoff effect does exist. And in the West, Feynman, you know, the Nobel Prize winner, the co-founder of electrodynamics, one of the greatest physicists that's ever lived, Riley...
Two Nobel Prizes.
Right. Mm-hmm. He very wryly commented in his book about the Baum-Aronoff paper, the gee guys, it only took us 30 years to look at this, you know. In other words, the effects were already in the literature and had been there for 30 years in 1959.
Oliver Heaviside had addressed this
at
the end of the century.
And even today, even after that, and after a man of that stature had commented on this and even printed the results of the experiment that shows conclusively that such things exist, the Baum-Aronoff effect exists. In the West today, all that we've really done with that is sit around and say, my, look at that. And in fact, it does have severe weapon implications for weapons. We see, as I've so often said on this program, the very severe indications that the Soviets have been rapidly weaponizing this stuff for about 30 years.
And doing some very unusual and unique...
Some very unusual things.
Ramon, I picked up a copy of Wireless World a few days ago at the Circus Bookstore, and in there is an article that addresses these alternative models of electrical transmission and current. I found it extremely interesting. Suggest you go pick up one before they're all gone. Another thing that I found remarkable, when we were working on scalar technology up in Utah about 3 years ago, after meeting, one of our colleagues asked Feynman why in his MIT lecture series he said that scalar communication would be the communication of the future. It's superluminal, faster than light, cannot be shielded, etc. He had totally forgotten that he had put this information in his lectures on physics, the books published at MIT, and we've often wondered why that change of heart. Tom, do you see a conspiracy theory here?
I don't see any conspiracy theory. I think the man, as the years passed, he went on to other things, and I think he just sort of forgot what he'd written in that very early books that he had been writing.
Well, the term scalar is just now getting into the vocabulary of a number of the physicists around the country, is it not?
Well, the term scalar electromagnetics has not been used. I use that because scalar is a perfectly good term. Mm-hmm. It means that you've lost the sense of direction.
Welcome back to Hour 2 of Open Mind. Tonight, I'm Bill Jenkins, delighted to have you along, and certainly delighted, finally, after all of these years, to have in studio with me Mr. Thomas E. Bearden, who has been teaching us for so much for so long. John Bedini is here, the young man who took the theories that Tom talked about and made them reality. Steve Wirth is here, who took the reality of Mr. Bedini and put it into hardware form. And Dr. Bob Beck is here, who has been looking into it and has cast his eyes down upon what John has done and says, it may work. And free energy is what we're talking about, an amazing device that runs, provides you with all the energy that you'll need. And the efforts now are underway to make sure that that gets into your hands as soon as possible. Greg is on the line. Greg, welcome aboard.
Good evening, Bill.
I figured you'd get in on this.
I'll stay out of the out-of-body stuff and ghost stuff, the Ghostbusters, but I'll get in on this.
Okay.
The closest thing I have a chance to proving by building these circuits from John's booklets and Tom's booklets. I think it's about time someone's got together and pushed for a Tesla National Monument or Tesla Museum here. Get the guy recognized.
I think it's well worthwhile. They spent a lot of time and effort to keep him underground, but he's not underground anymore.
Mm-hmm. To name some university hall or physics lab after him or something like that. School or something.
Well, they had a Tesla Centennial this year, sponsored by one part of the IEEE, and I understand from Elizabeth Rauscher that there's very strong consideration at the present time to continue that effort, maybe on an annual basis, as a memento to Tesla.
So a Tesla convention out here on the West Coast, or the pre-energy convention, you've had them back east, and it'd be nice to have a chapter out here.
I've talked to some people who are teaching electronics on the college level, teaching it, and they didn't know who Nikola Tesla was.
Well, at least they're naming magnetic units after Tesla now.
Yeah. I noticed in the paper, almost the headlines here, they had some nice earthquakes again Friday, and I wondered if you gentlemen felt them.
Yes, let me talk about that. I'm glad you mentioned that. There's been a rash within the last week, at least down what time I've been able to be outside in my work down at Huntsville. And I've been steadily photographing the giant radials I talked about before. I have a friend in Nashville who has worked out a procedure now for measuring the stuff that they're pumping the weather with when they're creating the radials. And the measurements have really been jumping for the last week or 10 days. So they're cranking this stuff up again, so I don't know what they're going to do to us, but they're going to let us have some real unpleasant weather before this thing is over.
Maybe we should backtrack just a little bit, Tom, about what you're talking about. We've talked about it before on the show, but it is your contention that the Soviet Union is pumping a type of scalar wave into a grid across the United States, and that starts doing funny things.
Yes, if you look at what we call the woodpecker signals, which Dr. Beck was one of the ones fundamentally responsible for calling strong attention to, they cranked up in the mid-70s, and if you look at the pattern of these, which our guys thinks they are over the horizon radars. If you look at the pattern where they intersect across the United States, across North America, in a beautiful grid pattern. We actually have the intersection pattern from a document that published how they intersect across the U.S. What we have seen, at least down in Alabama, we have seen, for example, the clouds react to this particular kind of stuff they're using, the scalar stuff. A cloud is formed of either a drop of water around a little dust particle, or if it's cold enough, a drop of ice around there. It's sort of floating up in the air, but it's a nonlinear system, and it's got a little particle of dust in there, so it's like a little semiconductor. The thing picks it up, detects it, and makes a little field. And once it makes a little field, a little force field, it can move the little droplet of water. And so the little droplets of water all line up. There is some reason to believe they may be using antennas, which are very similar to one of the forms that Rogers used, which was like in a circle where radios running out from the circle. Because one of the standard patterns that these little droplets of water in the clouds form when they're doing this in the grid, they form a almost complete circle, about two-thirds of a circle that'll be about 5 miles in diameter, a little thin ring of clouds. And then outside that, little thin lines of clouds running straight away, almost like a geometer drew them, straight away for about 15 or 20 miles. That's a very unusual formation if you ever see one. And I do have photographs of one now. I don't have as good a one yet as I want, but I got a pretty good one. And I've seen at least 15 of these myself personally, and on a show here before when we opened it up to callers, people reported from all over the country having seen these radials. There's another pattern where twins get together, two of them get together and join, and in that case the rings disappear on the outside. They join on the radials, and the lines get a little fatter, and they boat tail just like a missile ogive towards the center of where the ring had been. And we've seen and been photographing recently several of those.
Can you make any of those prints available to John Ratzlaff or anybody that we could get copies from? Somewhere?
As soon as I get one that I think is sufficiently good to convince the people that are hurling brickbats all over my head for daring to say that anybody can control the weather this way, then you bet you I'm going to publish an article on and print the pictures and the photographs and everything else. I'm using one in briefings right now.
Great. Has Bob Beck done any checking on this seven-cycle Earth resonance where I put up like a radio transmitter or antenna and tune to seven cycles and get free power from the Earth, or does it take more than that?
The power level is so low, it's down in the microgauss region, typically 50, 60 microgauss, that you can't extract much energy from it. It's even lower than all the radio stations several hundred miles away. But it is there. It is measurable. It's a very actual phenomena.
Is that what that L. Gordon Cooper, former astronaut, was doing? At Omni Magazine mentioned he had a corporation in San Diego, which I since disappeared or something.
No, Gordon Cooper used to be my vice president in Bechtech Corporation, and I briefed him on all of these good things. And I haven't seen him in a couple of years now. We sort of went our separate ways, and I'm not sure what he's doing these days.
Well, if we could get some of this free power one way or the other, we could have electric airplanes and cars and ion-powered spaceships that could accelerate real fast and visit the planets real fast and come back and...
It'll change the world, Greg.
What Gordon was doing was trying to, let's say, recreate some of the Tesla phenomena. I had, of course, shared with him a number of the papers that I fell heir to under very mysterious circumstances. And he knows all of the important people all over the world, and if anyone could pull it off, I think he'd be the man to do it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'd like to address some of John Bonini's work here. If you could later at some time leave Bill or somebody the addresses of the other men you mentioned in your latest booklet, Ken Moore, Lewis Plain, Ike Mueller, where to contact them if they're interested in talking about it. I've been able to reach Jim Watson in Colorado. He's over there now trying to tonight see if he could pick up the station. I think it's too far. He built the devices, as you mentioned in the previous show. And I also wanted to see what success you had with people buying your Energizer or duplicating your little NiCad circuit, the 5-volt NiCad that you have in your latest book, either of those two systems. I hadn't been able to build the circuit in time to say on the show whether it works or not.
Well, you're working on it, I bet you, though, right?
Well, I built the timer, and it doesn't work, just the power of the relay. Can't get enough current to trip the relay.
Got any tips for him there, John?
I did not build the digital timer that Ike Mueller and Ken Moore did. I used the SG-1534, which is a pulse width modulator, because that fires up every time. But My NICADs, I ran them at the convention in the charge mode in front of, I guess, 500-600 engineers, and actually called Ike Mueller out of the audience and said, would you please come up here to measure this? Of which Ike did, but I don't know how many people were listening out there. There was no strings. There was no big dark cloth over this thing. Anybody that wanted to measure it could measure it. In fact, I handed the schematic out, and I do have to apologize. I put the wrong number on the IC. These numbers flash around in my head all the time, and it's very rare that I ever get one number down right. But it does. It will do it. And you will find that that your switching diodes have to be extremely fast in that circuit. Otherwise, you find a short circuit current that will build there and actually short out a bank.
Are the ratings you have there the proper ones, or is there more information like the length of the wires and all?
Well, I used a 20 KC switching diode in there. MR852, I think it is. They use those in inverters. And I found that that diode there made it possible to run the NICAD bank. Now, with a lead-acid battery, you may have to search around and find another diode. I think Ken Moore found out that a regular automobile alternator diode worked in his circuits much more successfully than they would work in the NICAD circuits. But you have to remember one thing also, that a NICAD is not a lead acid. And the NICAD, if you heat that NICAD up, you're in danger of not charging anything. You have to keep it at a certain temperature where the lead acid can get a little bit hotter, and it'll charge.
How long has this circuit run without running down to this particular circuit with a NICAD?
Well, I ran the one with a NICAD. You'll notice that I had limiting diodes in there. I had just LEDs in there. And I did that for a reason. I didn't want to exceed 150 milliamps of charge current on these NICADs. Because if you do exceed that, what happens is they burst. In fact, I'm ready now that I might mention this, if it's all right with Bill and everybody here, that we'll be exhibiting this year at the CES show a preamplifier that runs on this particular technology that draws less than a tenth of a watt from the wall, and you can run this machine preamplifier all stages. Phono stage, AUX stages, all the stages concerned, tape output, everything, for about 4 days before you have to recharge this thing, and then it charges in 15 minutes when you throw the switch. We're going to be using a very special NICAD cell. It's very fast recovery, which Panasonic now has released, and these things are good for 12 amps for 12 minutes. Okay, so you can see that little integrated circuits and things like that with this type of technology, including some discrete circuits, will run for days before it needs a charge, and then in 15 minutes you can have it back up to charge and start playing away again. And I'll tell you what it will do. By getting rid of all the hash that's on the power lines and everything, why, the quality of these ICs goes up 100% or so.
Mm. Well, by building this exact circuit with exact parts, will it run forever, or does it run down within a couple of days? Is this highly efficient?
Okay, that's a real good question, okay? I think they have the terms mixed up, and I want to answer this question, but I want to run through something here real quick. The term perpetual motion, okay? Perpetual motion, in the way I look at it, is that's the Earth and we're sitting on it, okay? We don't go up there and oil any bearings on the Earth, okay? But these machines, we have to grease them, we have to tighten up nuts and bolts, so the term free energy is confused with the term perpetual motion.
Okay. Even the parts don't wear out, or they will wear out, and you have to replace them and stuff like
that.
Well,
technically, you know, solid-state devices are supposed to go forever, right?
Yeah.
Although I've seen that there's a limit to how long they'll go. Usually they'll go between 5 and 10 years without any failure if there's nothing that comes in there and gets in there and destroys any of the junctions. Now, you know, if you happen to walk up to something and hit it with an electrostatic spark or something, you're in jeopardy of never having your circuit
running. Okay, and I'll build this exact circuit. I'll call on the show within the next few weeks and let everybody know whether it works or not.
Okay.
What frequency does it? There's an adjusting knob. It doesn't say what frequency it works at or how to adjust it.
Well, that oscillator is set. It's predetermined by that switch. You see, one says high and one says low.
Uh-huh.
The low frequency is the charge pulse mode. Okay? The high frequency is there to drive the loads. In other words, you're not going to spin a motor, you know, with 5 hertz pulses. You follow me? What you want to do is you want to spin that motor at a higher frequency. In other words, you want to get up around above 60 hertz. Okay, so you can rectify that. Almost like a standard inverter. You see, what you're looking at there is a way to take the DC power and convert it into an AC potential, and then through the rectifier, convert it back to a pulsed DC.
I see you have 5 groups in NiCad instead of the 4 car batteries you have later on in the booklet. I assume all 5 groups of 5-volt NiCads will recharge then.
Well, the 5th group of batteries was to run the oscillator, okay? Because I didn't want to draw any energy from the 4 banks. I wanted to make an accurate measurement of the 4 banks, okay? But there's also a switch there that when you throw that switch, it goes in parallel with one of the banks,
so that
one charges too.
Oh, okay, great. Has anyone successfully built just by buying your controller a working device by hooking it right up to a motor and away they go? Or have you heard any feedback from your controller you had for available?
No, most of them are tinkering. They're trying to do other things with them, okay? Mm-hmm. Everybody has their own idea, and it's not for me to tell them about their ideas, okay? It's what they want to do with it.
Okay, Greg, does that help you?
Yeah, I'll call back if it works and let everybody know.
All right, thank you very much.
Bye.
I'm Bill Jenkins. It's Open Mind. We're 22 minutes past 10 o'clock with me, Tom Bearden, John C. Bedini. We have Steve Wirth and Dr. Bob Beck. We're talking about free energy and things related, and you're invited to get into it with us. Jenkins, and with me in studio is Tom Bearden, John Bedini, Steve Wirth, Dr. Bob Beck. We're talking about free energy, and Jack's on the line. Hello, Jack.
Yeah, Malibu Jack here, Bill.
Hello, Malibu.
Well, first of all, I'd like to let your guests know I'm very ecologically oriented, and I hate the idea of these damn oil companies, etc., raping Mother Nature of her fossils, etc., minerals, etc., and then polluting the atmosphere, the earth, and the human beings with all the products and byproducts of their damn petrochemicals.
Now,
I'd
Jack,
like to know.
Hey, Jack.
Yeah.
All right, please say word, but be nice about it.
Yeah, okay, definitely. I'll be as sweet as I can. Okay, but I would like them to know that I am a motorcycle buff, and I'd like to know if they could possibly extrapolate upon their ideas. Now, I'm setting out a challenge for them, you see. I know that it's necessary to use gasoline right now, unfortunately. But we've seen the results of it, and I'd like to know if there would be some way to make an engine to power motorcycles, possibly even cars, without having to use gasoline. Is that possible? And I'd like to put that challenge to you, gentlemen.
That's certainly possible. I would recommend at the present time you not put it in an automobile, not because you can't do it, but because I don't think you'd be allowed to do it.
Did you leave, Jack?
Lost him.
Well, Jack's left, but why do you say we wouldn't be allowed to do it, Tom?
Just my own personal opinion is I think that the powers that be this mysterious day needs a lot more time to adjust the oil situation, the cash flows, the international finances and all that. And so they're going to need a few years on that. If we can free up a lot of the utilities and all, we'll ease the pressure on the oil anyway. And as a matter of fact, if you've read... even this week, if you've read anything like Business Week or something like that, you discover a very amazing fact. There is an oil glut, and a very serious one, has been. And oil is down to 20-some-odd dollars a barrel.
That's terrific. It only costs 25 cents in Saudi Arabia to get it out of the ground.
Yeah, we haven't seen any decrease at the pump. But what I'm saying is the whole thing's artificial right now anyway. They're actually closing down, going after a lot of the new strikes and new places in the U.S. because unless it's economically feasible now, as the price falls, they don't move. So there's some very strong economic pressure right now on the oil anyway to drop the price. I think we're going to see the price come down anyhow.
Mm-hmm.
So right now, I don't think we better tamper with that. We've got enough battles to fight just trying to get a home power unit. But yes, indeed, you can build a power unit for an engine for a motor, for a motorcycle. You can also build it for a car or an airplane. As a matter of fact, the West Germans did exhibit a prototype little bitty motorcycle engine running down the highway using an energizer. It was electrically powered. It had a lot of flaws in it, a lot of bugs in it, but they did show that they could run the motorcycle approximately four times as far as the battery could possibly power it. They demonstrated that to a German government agency. And I don't really know at this time what's happened to that. That seems to be still hung up in the bugs and so forth.
They keep burning up the batteries.
I had an interesting aside on this. When Gordon Cooper and I were rather closely associated, he was trying to get alcohol fuel into the mainstream. And I was amazed to find that prior to World War I, almost all the tractors, automobiles, had carburetors that would work on either alcohol or gasoline. And this was rather dangerous to the Rockefeller and the petroleum industry. And I was absolutely amazed to find that the oil companies had enough clout to alter the Constitution of the United States. The Volstead Act prohibition was mounted not because the Women's Christian Temperance Union was angry with drunks, but they were trying to close down all of the backyard stills that would make the farmers independent, and the masquerade, the cover story was...
I've never heard that.
No, this is a part of our history that I'm sure you never learned in school, so don't underestimate the oil companies. They changed the Constitution of the United States to preserve their monopoly.
Well, that's certainly true, and it's also true that during World War II, for example, we've had technology as old as that. Hitler was able to fuel the German war machine almost entirely with synthetic fuel made from coal.
Right.
But he had to have tetraethyl lead in order to make it the Luftwaffe planes work, and he got that from the United States.
Right.
It was wonderful.
But the funny thing is, you know, we have all those captured German papers, and as far as I know, they've never even allowed the processes
that
we're using to be translated.
The processes, by the way, all of those papers are in the School of Petroleum Engineering at Texas A&M University.
Yeah, they're there. They're still there. In other words, any time we decided we really wanted to do it, we could certainly build synthetic fuel. And I believe the price quoted is a little cheaper than what we're paying for gasoline today.
They'd figure out a way to jump it up, I'm sure. It's 10:30 and Bob is on the line. Hello, Bob.
Hello, Bill.
Mm-hmm.
I'll address my question to John.
Yes.
John, recently I just got a $200 electric bill, so I, like many of your listeners, would like to know just how much more research has to be done before we can expect this thing to be put on the market or either bought up by some of the larger firms, Westinghouse or GE or whatever.
That won't happen.
Well, that's a tough question because don't feel lonely out there because mine just jumped from... $120 to $225 this month. So, but I think that has to do with they don't actually come in your backyard. What they do is they peer over your back fence with a little scope, and sometimes they mismark the numbers. But if you're curious about that, just call them up, and they'll be glad to send a man out with his loads and everything and test your meter. But my research work is basically complete at this time on what I've been working on. It's led me to some other work, okay?
Mm-hmm.
That seems to be real important right at this time. And but the capability, the possibility there is that the generator could do it. Well, let's look at it this way. It is possible right at this point in time with a few bars of iron and a couple of coils to put in 500 watts and get 1,000 watts worth of heat out, if that would help you.
But I think it'd help the Midwest much more, especially those people that can't afford the coal, right? Or the oil. The machine in its crude form, I have not been able to break. I have not been able to short it out. I've been not able to overheat it in any way. So it looks like in its crude form, it could, you know, supply some type of heating. But unfortunately, the funding right there, right at this moment, to get it into production isn't there right now.
Efforts are being made, underway.
Has any interest been shown overseas?
The answer is yes.
I think I'll have Bill or Tom answer that.
Okay.
Yes, the answer is very definitely yes. We'd rather not elaborate on that at the present time.
But okay, work is going on. You can rest assured about that, all right?
One last question. I missed the, failed to understand where this energy is derived from. How does the machine capture the energy?
To put it real simply, the vacuum is full of enormous amounts of energy in a very special form, a locked-up form. If you take the vacuum inside the machine, in the vicinity of the machine, and you sort of warp the vacuum, if you'll imagine that for a moment, mm-hmm. Imagine that the vacuum is a special kind of little particles in flux, almost like pressure in the molecules in a gas, mm-hmm. Only we call them virtual particles. And imagine, call that an ether. That's an acceptable term anymore. It's finally come back in. Imagine that what we do is we make a higher pressure ether in one part of the machine than is in the other part. And then the ether itself then forms a river between those two parts. Now, what we do, really do, is we tap that river. And the river is coming from nature. Nature's boundless energy. It's like being in an ocean and you tap the tops of the waves. You get some waves going and you tap the tops of them. Nature's providing the energy. And it's right there in the vacuum. That's where it's coming from. The physics verifies that the energy is there. We know today it's there in enormous amounts. And that's the way you get just a little bit of it. You got to bend things so that you get a little river and you tap the river.
Does that help you, Bob?
It does. One last question. Where can we get some literature? You mentioned that you had a book. Is that available in most bookstores?
All right. There are some papers that both Tom and John have written. You can get those from the Tesla Book Company at 1580 Magnolia, Millbrae, California, M-I-L-L-B-R-E-A.
A-E.
A-E. All right, got corrected there by the scientist. 94030 is the zip code up there.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
And we have, I guess, Richard is on the line. Hello, Richard.
Hello, gentlemen.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a fan of all of yours.
Thank you.
Thank you, Richard.
I have a question for John and a question for Dr. Bearden. And for Bob, too. In fact, for Bob, my question is, when do you answer your phone machine, if ever?
we've all been wondering about that.
That's a good question, Bob. When do you answer that phone system?
Oh, nightmare time. I must have got...
This is your conscience speaking.
Thank you, Uncle Richard. I've been the guest of a medical group in Minneapolis for a while. When I got back to town, I was just appalled at the traffic that had piled up years and years ago. I told any one of my secretaries who ever called me to the telephone would be fired on the spot. I don't know. I apologize for this. About once a day we go through 50 to 100 calls, see if there's anything there, and call back about 50% of them. So we'll get back to you sooner or later.
Okay, thanks. I've been building Tesla coils lately and becoming fascinated with induction. John, does your system work on the principle of induction?
Yes.
Is it high frequency, high voltage induction?
No. Not necessarily. But it does work on the principle of induction.
Well, my next project is going to be to try to build one of your devices.
Uh-huh.
Is there anything I need to know? To start,
yeah.
When you say the vacuum, now, is this a vacuum that you created, a blown piece of glass with a vacuum of some type?
No.
No, okay. What do you mean when you say the vacuum?
I think I'll turn that question over to Tom.
Okay, thanks.
But Tom, can we put the vacuum in some term that might be, you know, might turn on some light bulbs out there?
Imagine the empty space in front of you. We know there's air out there, right?
Right.
Now pull all the air out. That's left is what we call the vacuum.
Okay, and how does that apply to the actual device?
Okay, the vacuum is a thing that's been of enormous importance in physics for an awfully long time. They used to call it the ether, and now they're back to calling it the ether again. That went out of fashion, went out of favor for a long time, but now they're calling it that again. The vacuum, it turns out, the best way to model that is to imagine that it's filled with a whole bunch of little particles just going like crazy in every direction. These particles appear and disappear. They come into being, and they disappear from being. And that's what the vacuum is, a flux of these magic little particles which are going crazy, going in all directions all the time. That's the way modern physics represents the vacuum, and they call these virtual particles. They come into being so quickly, and they go out of being so quickly, that normally we can't measure one of them being there. But we can measure a whole bunch of them if they get together and gang up, so to speak, and clobber something. And physics today visualizes that all the forces of nature are caused by exchange of these little virtual particles doing just that with masses. And they make forces when they do that. That's the way they model it.
Okay, and then I did have a question for you. Could you clarify for me maybe the difference between the spatial potential in the third and the fourth dimension, where the space-time comes into play with the scalar width? I'm reading your work right now.
Yes, time is a funny thing. That's a very deep question you asked, and it'll take me just a moment to answer that. So please bear with me.
Definitely.
Time is a very funny thing. In the geometry that was originated to make a model and apply to relativity by Minkowski, time is used as a dimension. In other words, you make length, width, and height like you're normally used to seeing, and they say, hey, there's another right angle there, and we call that time. And it's a little bit more complicated than that, but basically that's it. And so they built what they call a four-dimensional geometry, and they call that space-time. In other words, four dimensions. Space being L cubed, or length, time length, time length, and then times time gives you space-time. Now, in quantum mechanics, time is not an observable. What that means is you can't detect time. There's never been such a thing as a clock in the true sense. You see spatial positioning, for example, when you look at a hand. You see the two hands of a clock. And if you see a change in the spatial position of the hands on that clock, you infer that time has passed. Now, you may infer that very precisely if you use instruments, but you don't measure the time itself. You actually measure the spatial positioning on the hands. You measure something spatially always, according to quantum mechanics. So we have a quandary when we start talking about measuring something. Because here we have models that says, well, the world is made up of space-time, this thing that came from relativity. And yet every time we measure, we only measure part of that. We lose the time, you see. So that's one of the reasons that quantum mechanics and relativity have never really been quite well patched together. They're still not quite as patched together as they should be. Anyway, the space-time business, what you're reading in my papers is in the old days they didn't know about you could change the rate of flow of a thing through time. That came along with relativity. Well, they put together the foundations of electromagnetics long before relativity came along, and they made it entirely spatial. So they made the idea of the electrostatic scalar potential. It became a spatial thing. And what I pointed out is, say, hey guys, take that Minkowski geometry, use the four dimensions. Well, the electrostatic scalar potential is a stress on all four. It's not just the stress in the space. That's what I'm pointing out in that paper.
Excellent. Thank you.
Okay, Richard, I'm glad that helped you.
Perfect. Thank you very much for your show.
You betcha.
Good night.
Greg, you're on.
Hello, Bill.
Well, you made it.
Oh, it's wonderful. I thought we'd never talk again, but your producer came through.
Oh, very, very good. Well,
I basically was planning on concentrating on the economics, but I have a couple of things I have to get in quickly. And by the way, I have to make an observation here. I mean, I can remember 10, 15 years ago, as a rather young person, learning just the basic idea of virtual particles, and it seemed evident to me at the time that we exist in kind of an energy matrix in the universe. And if that was clear to me then, it's kind of surprising that so many people have trouble figuring that out.
You were a little avant-garde, I think.
I don't know. I mean, it seems like a very obvious concept. anyways, let me just ask you a couple of things quickly. First of all, Tom, you were just saying you were just using the term ether. You're not really using it in the way that it used to be used, are you?
No, that's correct. They used to think of the ether as being a material, that is, an observable ether. It was very thin, very ethereal, but it was there and it was real and it was observable by your instruments. Today, that's not the way they visualize it. It's visualized as totally being full of virtual particle flux. And
all
so
right.
The difference is, the change is, it's a virtual gas now instead of an observable, thin observable gas.
I was just wondering if it might not be a good idea to come up with a better term, because that could be misleading for a lot of people who are familiar with the old concept.
Well, I agree, but the term has come back into existence in physics. It is now being used in physics papers, published in journals, and is an accepted term because it's now understood in the modern sense.
So they're just redefining it.
They just redefined it. That's correct.
Good. Now, one other thing before we get to economics. I was interested. My ears really perked up when you mentioned Richard Feynman a ways back, because I have the highest regard for him, both as a scientist and as a human being. And I just wonder if you could elaborate on his connection. I guess it's basically with the theoretical basis of this. I gathered from what you were saying that he hasn't really...
No, as a matter of fact, one of the real inspirations for me has been Feynman's three volumes of physics. You can get excellent theoretical treatments of physics in many books, but Feynman has probably, in that series of books, has done a better job than almost anybody else I know of in expressing the actual concepts in a manner in which you can understand them. If you read the book about the concepts, you can begin to see a little deeper into what the things really mean than the normal physics text gives you. It's a very excellent series of books, and that's my connection with Feynman was in reading his three volumes of physics.
I was just wondering if you could elaborate on his connection with the concepts that connect with for energy systems.
I don't think he's connected with them. I think Dr. Beck, pointed out that when approached by a former student of his, he did not recall writing the von Aronoff material in those three books. This was some years later, of course.
Right. Okay. Well, let's talk about economics then. Have you got any kind of rough plans for scaling these devices up to industrial size, shall we say?
Answer is yes.
Do you have estimates as to the capital costs?
Well, we're getting pretty particular here, Greg. I'd really rather not go into the real specifics of that because... we're trying to do some negotiations, and I don't want to do anything or say anything that might reflect on those. Let me put it this way. I don't see any obstacles. The principles are there, and they are scalable. Let's put it that way. There doesn't seem to be any problem in scaling particularly the devices that John has right now.
No problem.
Uh-huh. let's say a scenario of maybe not an ideal future, but what you could best expect to happen. What percentage of the present energy use could be substituted with free energy devices?
Maybe I can answer that question from some of the measurements that I've made, okay? Let's look at it this way. You probably only need one generator the size of what's in Boulder Dam down below. And you could probably take care of 3/4 of the United States.
You're talking about the electrical need?
Yes. You could probably take care of 3/4 of the United States. And you'd have to find some way. You'd have to make such a big output port, because what this thing does is as the power needs increase... In the U.S., what would happen is you would find out that the water was being pushed through the turbine or sucked through the turbine rather than the turbine being pushed.
It turns it back, it goes backwards. Yeah.
It's sort of a back EMF type generator, okay? In other words, it's you view it this way, okay? take your hand and stick it over the end of a vacuum cleaner, and what happens when you stick your hand over the intake port of that vacuum cleaner?
Yeah, the airflow increases.
That's right, but the motor speeds up, right?
I never really checked that out, I guess, you know.
Well, you check that out sometime. You'll find out that the motor races away, but yet your hand's still stuck to the end, okay?
Oh, I see what you're saying, sure.
That's exactly what this generator does. The bigger the demand load on it, the faster it wants to turn. So the governor effect would be the water that the turbine's sucking in on initial start. In other words, you'd have to find, well, I'm sure they could do it, you know, mechanics is great, but you would have to limit the port on the output of the turbine, in other words, to control the speed of the generator, or otherwise you would find yourself with sucking the dam dry.
Yes, you wouldn't necessarily want to put this all in one large generator, would you?
Certainly. Certainly you would.
For what reason?
Well, why have 40,000 generators all over the place?
Well, for backup. I could give you a number of reasons why.
Well, let me hear one of yours.
Well, I mean, if it fails, that's it, right? That's the first obvious one. But second of all, you've got to...
Let me point out one thing right now. I will make this claim.
Okay.
You cannot short this generator out. If you short it out, it speeds up. Okay? There is no more power if you short it out. You follow what I'm telling you?
Yeah, I understand that.
So therefore, the only failure that could occur on this would be a burned-out bearing or a broken main shaft. Okay?
That's what I'm talking about.
Okay, so what you would need is maybe two of these generators, then one just standing there doing nothing, right?
They had
a bunch of turbines at Boulder Dam.
Right. I mean, they got how many generators sitting in there right now?
Yeah.
Okay.
Maybe
a whole bank of them. What I'm suggesting is that if you're going to build one and you want to supply power, then build a big enough one that can carry this power. Also, you will find out with this kind of generator that you need one wire. We are supplying loads right now with number 30 wire.
Size of your hair, smaller.
Okay.
Wow. So you're saying basically then your concept would mean we'd have to upgrade the energy grid to handle this?
Well, I don't think the normal energy grid, okay? You see, the normal energy grid is a two-wire system, okay? We don't push any electrons in this system. We just let them go by themselves. In other words, the smaller the wire, the more energy we seem to derive from this mechanism, okay?
It's backwards.
Yeah, it's a backwards generator. In other words, as I explained earlier in the program, the lower the load impedance, the generator becomes proportional to the load. In other words, if the resistor is, say, 4 ohms and the resistor is rated at 25 watts, that's exactly what you're going to find that the generator puts to the resistor. However, if you increase the resistance on this type of generator, you will find out that as you increase the resistance, the power is increased also, which is completely backwards from what we know.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you, by the way, have you come across anything in that, you know, any previous theoretical physics that would point to such a happenstance?
Well, yeah, yes, Tom Bearden has pointed that out many times, that the answers already lie in these books. It's just we don't seem to pay attention to them for some reason.
The problem is the answers are in about 4 or 5 different fields or different places that have not been connected except by, you know, you have the individual researchers like John Medina, like Dr. Beck and so forth, that have put fields together that in the textbooks and in the common teachings are not put together. That's the problem.
I wonder if an equivalent there would be a constant current analog. If you have an infinite impedance source, it will put the identical current into any load because the source impedance is much higher than the load.
It works somewhat similar to that.
Yes, it does. It's also a series resonance system. So whatever the load power requires, you will find that exact duplicate in the generator itself.
Reflected?
It's a reflected power, and this is what enables the generator to accelerate because the magnetic fields, more or less, become the same poles then. You follow what I'm saying? so far. In other words, the generator, if you have a north pole and a south pole on a generator, and it was a series resonance system, what would happen is the bigger magnetic field overpowers the little magnetic field, and so the smaller magnetic field wants to repel from the bigger one because it wants to become the like, same like pole. Do you follow what I'm telling you?
Are you with us there, Greg?
Yeah, I'm not quite sure on the last part. I'm taping this.
There you go.
I go over it again. All right, Greg, does that help?
Well, I'll just leave you with one other part of the economics. You had a question before about using it to substitute for gasoline. I'm just wondering, so far you've just been concentrating on implementing this in the electrical generating system, but what about other energies, since electricity is only rather small portion of our overall energies?
First things first, I guess, is the best way to look at it.
Well, it has an enormous number of applications, and this I will not go into on the air, but...
I always ask these questions.
No, I'm going to give you where it leads, for example, to give you some idea. If you begin to look at what we're calling scalar waves, this vector zero, and you can imagine that as a potential that increases and decreases but never allows a gradient. That's one way to look at it. The gradient always remains horizontal. Another way to look at it. Another way to look at it is the potential the whole system rises equally across the system. All the same thing. But if you have that rising and falling, you find that you have a wave. Now, what a mass is, in the first place, a particle of mass, is nothing in the world but a standing scalar wave. Not the normal electromagnetic wave at all, but a standing zero wave. Once you understand that, you can build currents of scalar resonance. You can suck the mass and inertia right out of an object, or you can put mass and inertia into an object by currents that you can flow through wires, and at that point, I won't say any more.
Well, that ought to help you as you go over your tape recorder there, Greg.
You know, you just sparked up one last thing, and I'm going to hang up. This is a real... This is out of left field. Do you see any application for anything... for deriving from anything you've been working on that would enable us to neutralize nuclear weapons?
Well, let's put it this way. You could get rid of all those hot waste that we're piling up and we've got to find some place to store. And can you neutralize nuclear weapons? Yes, indeed, 100%.
You're talking about interfering with radioactive decay or what?
Yes. I'm also talking about dudding electromagnetic circuits at a distance. If they're harmful circuits like what's going to bring a nuke down on top of your head, you can do that. You can do a lot of other things. You can put so much energy on the thing that you just melt everything or vaporize it.
It's a wonderful thing.
You're saying there's a direct interaction or coupling with the forces that govern
radiation? There's a good body of knowledge which shows clearly that you can change the rate of radioactive decay, and you can do it with electrostatic scalar potential, for example.
Hmm. Okay, Greg.
Okay, thank you so much.
You betcha.
Bye-bye.
I'm Bill Jenkins with Tom Bearden, John C. Bedini, Steve Wirth, and Dr. Bob Beck. You know, the best place to spend the holidays this year is people to cover the territory with tonight. Tom Bearden is in studio. Tom, so glad to have you with us. Usually you're stuck away on that telephone in Huntsville, Alabama, so it's nice to hear what you really, really sound like and look like. John C. Bedini is here, the young man who has put together the device that will make free energy. Steve Wirth is here, the young man who puts together John Bedini's ideas, and then the two of them hassle back and forth and come up with all kinds of rather incredible things, wouldn't you say, John? Tom?
Yes.
And Dr. Bob Beck is here, who, he's been so much a part of this for so long that it's kind of fun to have you along, too. But I guess it's fun for you to see these things finally coming to fruition. You knew they always would.
About time.
So it takes a lot of minds working together, and I think that's one of the reasons that you four want to be on a show like this tonight, to stimulate somebody's imagination out there. There are a lot of very brilliant men and women who are in physics and who are in science, and this matter of energy and scalar interferometry and all of the promise that it holds for mankind needs the combined genius of everyone who can jump in the fray and get with it. That's the way I feel. So, let's get back to our callers. We have Brian on the line. Brian, welcome aboard.
Thank you very much. I just can't wait until they're on again. So I have so many questions right now. I just keep it to a very small amount.
Okay.
One of them, which is, in the Vietnam War, the F-16s that had no reason for being downed. I understand that some of the inferences, some of the devices that the Russians were using downed these things. Can anybody give an answer to that?
Well, I think, yes.
Well, you're talking about the F-111.
F-111, yeah.
They had a very mysterious loss pattern. F-111s had some problems that were ordinary problems, of course, but the particular pattern I'm referring to, some eight or so of the F-111s were lost very quickly after they were deployed and very mysteriously. In other words, no mayday messages, no nothing. And then we didn't lose any more for some 4,000 missions. Well, when you have something that's that sharp an anomaly, it pays to look at it. What I think happened, I think that the Soviets wanted to get that hot new airplane, and they simply brought in a modification to a conventional, probably SA-2 radar, and they knocked down enough of them, which I am quite sure you can do with the scalar stuff. And after they got enough, they took the modification out and took it back to Russia with all the information they needed on the F-111. Now, we recovered one crew from the prisoner of war exchange. Now, they themselves, of course, don't think anything about a special kind of weapon or anything. They don't really know what knocked them down, but they did notice that all the systems, all the failure lights lit up at one time. Now, that airplane has like three redundant control systems. It's built to take extremely heavy punishment and still keep flying. And every system on the airplane was failing at once. That's the key. And that is a direct signature of this kind of thing. That's exactly what you would get if this was in fact what happened. In other words, that doesn't prove it, but it is certainly consistent with that approach. We do know the Soviets have the weapons.
Well, another question is, our government right now, it's the largest buildup in military probably in our history, as far as financially, and because of that, it makes you wonder where the expenditures are going. And what we have right now is, with the scare effect, is a possibility to not only stop what they're doing, but also to augment it in our systems. Is there anything going on in our government this time, or do you know of anything that could help us stop this and, of course, bring us up to speed?
Well, of course, I don't make any secret of the fact that for some period of years I've been trying to convince our government of this particular kinds of effects, of these kinds of effects. Certainly Beck and other people have exerted enormous effort to try to call attention to the electromagnetics of certain situations to them. Beck has even gone so far as to actually demonstrate a device through a Faraday cage to them and to their complete disbelief, even though they saw it working. But there's a very long history of people trying to convince the government that there are some problems in this area and we should be doing something. Now, that's having an effect, I guess is the way I'd have to say it. But at this time, I don't believe there's any real ongoing programs that are devoted towards really what I'm calling scalar electromagnetics. I hope there will be, because we need defenses.
Are they suffering from the NIH syndrome, not invented here?
Exactly.
Okay. There's an interesting aside on this. Esteemed caller and Tom, about 2 years ago, the government sent out seven colonels. Have you heard this story? The Committee of Seven, to investigate technology that they felt might be essential to this country's staying at least caught up with the Soviets. And there was unanimous agreement that ELF, extreme low frequency effects, the entire committee pointed out that this was the top priority in the entire technological scene today. Further down this list, a friend of mine, Jack Halk, and his PK metal bending was on the list. When the colonels took this list back to General Marsh, he struck out any mention whatever of ELF. Now, this brings up an interesting question. Has some of this money gone into experimentation to catch up with the Soviets in this area? Did they consider it so important that they did not want any additional input or investigation? In other words, these little anomalies stand out like a sore thumb if you're a Pentagon watcher. And we really have no answer to why some of these areas have gone totally dark. Do you have any ideas on that, Tom?
Well, in my opinion, I don't think they believe that there are any extensions to electromagnetics, and the reason is very simple. Large programs are very bureaucratically handled. There's a, goodness gracious, there's 100 different agencies and committees and this and that that can harass, harangue, delay, destroy, cut, connive, change, or just completely stop a program. Anybody who's worked in the system knows in our system today it's almost impossible for anybody to have enough authority and ever be given enough funds with that authority to go ahead and build anything. They keep delaying, changing the idea of what they want to build because some other group comes in and says, no, that's not what we want. So I think what happens is most of those people who are party to making those kinds of decisions or make the effects, they really had their training a long time ago. What training they had was classical electromagnetics. They think everything is already well understood and in the book, and there's never going to be anything else new except what they got. And if you tell them that radar is the end of it, or is not the end of it, they're going to look at you and tell you they already well understand radar and there's nothing else you can do with it. So I think that problem, you can call that the not invented here syndrome or whatever, most of them don't know anything about quantum mechanics, or if they do, they go to the other extreme. If they're qualified in quantum mechanics, they tend to think that the textbook is already the end-all and be-all. So the real problem we have, also, we're not good at nonlinear stuff at all. The Russians have led the world for years in nonlinear mathematics. They've always been the best nonlinear mathematicians in the world. And I think the sum total of all of this means that the odds against us having anything like that are very long indeed. I don't know of anything we have in the way of scalar weapons or even any appreciable kind of effort to look at the field. And in fact, you know, I've been exerting an enormous effort in my own personal life to try to convince them of the fact that we have a grave danger and we have to do something about it. I will say this, they've quit laughing.
That's a good step.
They're taking it seriously, but they haven't yet moved to do anything about it. So I would characterize that as saying, the elephant is shuffling his feet, but he ain't got on the ball yet.
Does that help you, Brian?
Yes, I think one other question is that because of being able to down the 111s, that our particular aircraft can also have a device which could counteract that. Maybe Mr. Bearden could explain how that's done. I remember reading in some of his material that there was a device that could be built to counteract the scalar effect coming from the radar from the ground.
Another scalar device.
Well, it's like, you know, using a sword against a sword. You fight a scalar device with another scalar device. The weapons I'm most worried about right now are the cold explosion kinds of things, like happened at April the 9th, 1984, 200 miles from downtown Tokyo in the ocean off Japan. I've discussed that before, and I don't want to dwell on it at length. I pointed out that there have been 77 other such plumes or explosions, whatever you want to call them, seen in the Soviet Arctic by our weather satellites since 1974. I do want to give one new piece of information because I know this stuff is being recorded. And this one you need to know. If we have a cold explosion at a distance, if we extract an enormous amount of energy there, the energy emerges at the weapon and you have to dump it. Now that one in the ocean, arising from the ocean on April the 9th, was, depending on the various article you read, it was 150 to 200 miles in diameter, somewhere of that size, rather enormous. So there's an enormous amount of energy was suddenly and violently extracted from that area. So somebody somewhere has got to dump an awful amount of energy. I'm going to give you a reference because we have found the smoking gun. Okay, if you will check Aviation Week and Space Technology, September the 26th, 1983, page 31, and you got that on your tape now, I hope. You will find satellite photographs of the Soviet island of Bennett Island, about 350 miles north of the Soviet mainland, near the Arctic Circle. And you will find an exhaust coming out of the ground there that's about 150 miles long. Explosive puffs in it to show that it's explosively initiated. We've seen quite a few of them and taken pictures of them with our weather satellites. And that's a reference, and you can look at the picture yourself, and that's a good reference.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the work you're doing, and please keep it up. We need it, and I hope that the government will listen and so will the military.
Okay, Brian, thank
you.
Mm-hmm. KABC time now is 18 minutes past 11 o'clock. It's Open Mind. I'm Bill Jenkins. Sal is on the line. Hello, Sal. You're on.
Hello.
Yeah.
Hi, this is Sal from South Bay.
Okay, Sal.
I'd like to mention something relative to your work John Bedini and Tom Bearden and Dr. Beck and so forth, Steve Worth. And I'd like to ask about three or four main questions. But first I want to give my postulate to the Bill Jenkins Show being on nightly instead of only once a week.
Why do you want to do that to me for?
Well, because you deserve it. And we deserve you.
I think
you're great.
I think Mrs. Jenkins would really want to wring your neck.
I think you're important to have around, Bill.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that. Yeah.
Okay, a few years ago, I worked on helping a friend raise some money to help fund the research on a special project. And this friend of mine made a motor or a device that ran basically on air pressure, started it, and did the most unusual things that I could not even begin to justify some of the phenomena. But he was harassed by the local government.
Was that Carl Epger?
Carl who?
Epger.
Carl Martin?
Epger.
Epger.
Agatha.
Agatha, yes, yes.
Yeah, you know about him.
Oh, yes. I spent quite a bit of time with the device.
Oh, great. I wanted that to happen. I could not even begin to describe it. I mean, I was there. I tried to help the man, and I'm very concerned about his work.
So. I tried to help him, too. Many's the test we ran, and I don't think I'd better comment any further.
Right. I don't want to comment either because it stupefied me, and that. But I do hope that he can be supported and helped, if you know what I mean.
I know what you mean, and we all had great hopes for the device, and it was rather unusual, and there may have been some psychotronic involvement. His son apparently had quite a bit of PK going on around him. It was the most amazing thing. My buddy Ed Skilling got out there, and I tried to get astronaut Gordon Cooper involved. And you've been out to his installation. He hired off-duty moonlighting cops and had incredible security. How long ago have you seen the device?
About 2 years ago.
Uh-huh. Well, I think you're a little bit more updated on it than I am. It was totally unpredictable.
What kind of device was it? What did it do?
Well, he built up a head of compressed air, and it was sort of an open turbine-like device, like a tea kettle with a spinning top. And I don't know.
It would exhaust. You would take 40 pounds of pressure to start it, and it would exhaust 120 pounds plus, and then the damn thing would accelerate, and you couldn't keep it on, otherwise the thing would go crazy.
Right, I know. I've been out there when the floors were shaking.
Yeah, and you had to screw it into the floor.
Right.
Otherwise it would float. And then the thing had very strong implications of antimatter, and it would physically affect matter in a transmutative way, in a positive way though, and it seemed to use the energy of the spin of the Earth, or sort of like a miniature solar system.
He had an absolutely amazing story that he laid on some of the investors. I believe what tripped him was in the Securities and Exchange domain.
Yeah. Well, just by bringing a battery near the damn thing, it would make it three or four times as powerful just by bringing it in close proximity. And it achieved ultrasonic fluid flow.
Well, one test that apparently turned out positive was the change in the modulus of elasticity of titanium and some other metals.
Right.
I remember the work that was done on that by one of the local aircraft plants, but I wasn't able to replicate with my own instruments some of the other claims.
I was interested in doing some biological experiments with the thing, but we never got that far.
Okay, well, listen, Sal, thank you for
I had a couple of questions.
Okay, quick.
Okay, quick questions. Have you ever heard of Walter Russell?
Mm-hmm. Everybody's nodding their head, yes,
everyone.
Have you ever done anything or tried to apply any of the work or know anybody that's involved with any of the work?
I don't know.
No.
No, because I think that's important. If you haven't found out about it, it's something you should know about. And then I read a book that indicated evidence that the government already was capable of transmitting energy to an exact location to the point of bringing a body riding in a car, burning it up while it was riding in the car without burning the clothing. Do you have any knowledge of this type of thing?
I never heard of that, Sal.
Alternative 3?
No, I've never heard the government do anything like that. Of course, I've heard of the phenomenon of spontaneous combustion of bodies. But
have you read the book Alternative 3?
Are you familiar with Alternative 3?
Yes.
I've read it.
Leslie Watkins has been on the show a couple of times. He'll be the first to tell you that it was a work of fiction.
It was.
However, he says evidently he hit some very, very sore nerves along the way, even though it was a total work of fiction, and is continuing his investigation, and he's found out some quite incredible things working with the House of Lords.
Okay, two more quick questions.
No, Sal, I'll tell you what, there are too many lined up here to go. But I do appreciate you sharing all of that with us, okay? And we're going to go on to Don. Hello, Don. Welcome aboard.
Hi, Bill. Nice to talk to you this way.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Bearden, when you first described matter as a standing scalar wave, the first thing that came to my mind was the possibility of transporting matter in wave form. Were you implying that some such thing was possible?
Yes.
Uh-huh. But I take it you don't want to comment any further.
I'd rather not go any further. I will tell you what, you know, how to visualize that standing scalar wave, though, to give you a better visualization. Imagine you have a cavity, and you have a wave traveling back and forth from wall to wall, reflecting off the wall. Now, if you take a plane in the middle and you suddenly stop the wave just as crossing that plane, stop it instantly, for a normal standing wave, you would have still, at that instance, you'd only have one ordinary electromagnetic wave with an electric field and a magnetic field in that plane. Now, that's the wave front I'm describing. Now, if you had a scalar wave there, you would have essentially two or more of those ordinary electromagnetic plane wave fronts, and the summation of the E fields would be zero, and the summation of the B fields would be zero.
Uh-huh.
But if you look at each one independently, it looks like a normal standing wave. You just have two or more of them that sort of self-cancel, and yet the self-cancelization is a zero vector system. It is not a nothing. That is a standing scalar wave, and that's what mass is, and that's what gives you inertia.
Could you comment on the relationship between possible scalar standing wave and the quantum mechanical waves that are, at least our models from quantum mechanics, make up all physical particles?
I think it's very closely related to the de Broglie wave, which, you know, the matter wave.
Uh-huh.
The fact that we regard or interpret, I should say, excuse me, the de Broglie wave as being a probability wave, the Schrodinger wave for as being a probability wave. Probability automatically involves time. As long as the thing has not collapsed in time, the wave function has not collapsed, then you have probabilities involved. You can speak of probabilities. And so I think what we're describing is very closely connected to the probabilities or the propagation of those probabilities. If you control this kind of wave, it would seem that you actually are beginning to control and change the actual probabilities assigned to the quantum mechanical states themselves.
Uh-huh.
So it appears possible to do that with scalar waves.
So that can affect quantum mechanics in the...
You violate one of the primary assumptions...
of quantum mechanics.
Quantum mechanics, that is, that below the zero in the virtual state, that everything is really chaotic and
right.
Random.
Uh-huh.
We're saying that when you put together deliberate vectors that make a zero vector, you have placed those active vectors down in the virtual state. You are now engineering the pre-physical reality, uh-huh, pre-collapse state directly, and so you can affect the Schrodinger wave in the individual states.
Which is what some theorists were positing all along.
Yes, Baum's, particularly David Baum.
Right. Another thing, last time you were on this show, I remember you spoke about violations of the second law of thermodynamics.
Yes.
And I didn't really follow them, but I was wondering if you could perhaps mention the implications for physical time travel.
Oh boy! Well, of course, the best way to look at physical time travel, I think, would be to look at a system that has many more dimensions than four. If you look at that, you can sort of go outside the system of the little time points you're looking at now, and you can come back in somewhere else by moving through a hyperdimension or a higher dimension. That's the easiest way to look at that. And so, of course, if you can operate in higher dimensions, then, and you're using that kind of model, you theoretically could travel through what we call time. Time becomes itself many-dimensional, not just a single dimension as its model.
I notice you mentioned physical time travel. You realize that time travel is being accomplished non-physically by the out-of-body travelers.
Well, that's why I put it that way. Yeah, that's why.
Well, you know, the funny thing is we're all traveling through time anyway. in physics anyway. We're already time travelers, and in fact, we know the rate at which we travel through time can be changed. That's just relativity. The thing is that we have all kinds of arguments and interpretations about whether or not we can travel backwards. I believe, here I'd have to be very cautious in what I'm saying. I'd have to go back and check my notes. But I believe that at least some of the latest solutions to some of the general relativity things suggest that you can travel backwards in time.
But you're not presently pursuing any of those avenues, scalar...
In my opinion, John Bedini's motor makes some negative time and makes some negative, what I would call negative energy. And I think we've got some very unusual effects going on there that's going to take all the physics we ever heard of and then some to explain. We just don't have a really good model to describe that yet.
Just one more thing I wanted. I know a lot of people must be waiting. I would like it if you could clarify a little bit more actually what a scalar wave is. I understand the canceling of two vectors so that you basically have a zero vector field, and then there is still...
I'll make it very simple. Imagine you have a steel plate about an inch thick between your fingers. You're pressing, but you've got very strong fingers. You're pressing very hard against both sides of that plate with all your fingers, but the force is all balanced to zero. Now, that's a zero vector system. The resultant is zero.
Right.
However, that's a very different plate from one that has no forces at all on it. It's under stress. Now imagine that I rhythmically vary the force with which I press on all my fingers. You know, I sinusoidally vary that, rhythmically increase and decrease the pressure with which I'm pressing on the plate.
Okay.
In other words, I squeeze and relax on the plate. Now, the plate still always has a resultant zero. It doesn't accelerate, doesn't wiggle, doesn't give you any detection. But there is a rhythmic stress wave that is now being created in that plate medium.
Right.
Now throw away the plate, leave the vacuum, and instead of my fingers, use electromagnetic forces, and you have just created a scalar wave in the vacuum.
Now, what relation does that have to virtual particles?
That, since it's in the zero, since you have made a deliberate zero system, and these are time-varying, you have folded in ordinary vectors inside a zero. That means they're inside the virtual state. Now, they are below the observable state. You have now placed specific, determined vectors, not random stuff, down in the virtual state, and you can use it to engineer it. You can hit, for example, all of the frequencies in the nucleus. You can interfere with the virtual particle interactions going on, the binding the nucleus together and everything else. You can get at all of that now.
But this is, in effect, these are normal electromagnetic the waves that you're starting out with.
Each one individually. Is.
Uh-huh.
But the system of them put together with the resultant zero is a quite different breed of cat from a normal electromagnetic wave. They'll go through a Faraday cage, for example.
You know we're going to give a quiz at the end of the hour, Doc.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, thank you. You know, the best place, midnight, to open mind. I'm Bill Jenkins, and we've got school in session here. And I hope you're paying attention. Tom Bearden is along with John Bedini, Steve Worth, and Dr. Bob Beck. We're talking about free energy. We've gotten into a few other things, like scalar interferometry and vector forces and little particles that are not going anywhere but are under stress time. I couldn't pass the quiz, Tom, if we... Let's see how well Glenn is doing. Glenn, welcome aboard.
Hello, thank you very much. I feel like an absolute novice at this sort of thing, but I'm certainly interested in it.
Join the club.
Years ago, in the late 30s, I was experimenting with Tesla coils and such things, and I never realized the importance that Tesla himself had given to us in the way of science until listening to your program more or less recently.
Well, thank you.
But one of the things that came up in the 40s, because of friends that knew that I was interested in electrical things and electronics and that sort of thing, was a diagram, which I still have the copy of it, of a device for, quote, free energy that was developed by a man by the name of Hendershot.
Oh,
I hear a chuckle back there.
It's like a fob.
is there any connection with what you're doing?
Well, I spent a great deal of time with this. So did several colleagues of mine. In the opinion of some very competent observers, it actually worked. But no one else could start the device except Lester Jennings Hendershot himself. And I think he made fairly conclusive demonstrations that it would provide a couple of hundred watts of power. It had some remarkable qualities. It only worked when he was, well, when he either started it or was in the room with it.
Huh.
And this is very, very far out, but a number of people felt that perhaps it was a psychotronic type phenomena similar to poltergeist energy.
Uh-huh.
Now, that's further out than I like to normally go, but a number of those devices were built that were absolutely totally identical to the one that he made. There were little basket weave coils, and there was a telephone magnet, and I've had several of these, one or two of which were actually working. He died down in Cyprus a number of years ago, but some of the devices are still kicking around.
Uh-huh.
And I spent dozens of hours analyzing every inductance, impedance, LC factors, resonant mode. I could do nothing with it, and I have quite a few gray hairs to prove it. But the Lester Jennings Undershot device was one of those apocryphal, let's say, parts of history, like the T. Henry Moray device. And I could tell you stories about that one all night long, but I won't.
Uh-huh. Well, the thing that interested me about it at the time when it was approached to me was because I had been brought up by a family of Hendershots.
Well.
But it has apparently no connection with Lester. I have since gotten into ham radio and electronics of various kinds, and I'm doing service work and repair work on, commercial equipment, home equipment of various kinds. But I'm interested in delving a little deeper into this thing, and I understand there were some writings that were available from a Tesla.
Well, there's more than writings. More than just Tesla. John has some papers available. Tom does. In fact, John, I think you have a videotape, do you not?
Yeah, we made a tape. It's not very good quality, but it's I apologize for that, but it does show you the G field type generator running, and it there's some very strange things. Let's say there's some very strange things going on. There's like when you phase this type generator correctly, it'll pop quartz lights, just explode them. It'll also run 1/5 horsepower motors that you can't stop, and nobody can figure out where the power is. With halfway rectifiers, it'll put into a battery bank 16 amps at 100 volts across the rectifier, and according to everything that I've been taught, you know, it's volts times amps is watts.
Yeah.
So that sounds like some material you could get into.
Yeah, you can. That could prove some points to you about some of these out-of-phase systems, or what they call nonlinear systems. Its best performance to date has been with the quartz heaters and the battery banks. In other words, for some reason, the battery banks offer some form of impedance to it, and they just you can regulate it, by the way, now. And you can save the battery from boiling away.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Well, now is the to understand that the higher the impedance, the higher the wattage gets out?
That's right. That's the if you have say a 4-ohm load, and you put so many volts across that 4-ohm load. Let's say you put 10 volts across that 4-ohm load. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that's going to be so many watts. What I've noticed with this generator is that you can take that 25-watt resistor, and the resistor stays absolutely dead cold.
Uh-huh.
Okay? Yeah, so if the load's low in Z or ohms, its output is low proportional to what the load is. Okay?
Uh-huh.
However, what is not explained is the acceleration, and the speed of rotation is non-important. In other words, if you had a generator, let's take your car alternator for an example. It has to be at so many RPMs or it doesn't put anything out, right?
Right.
Well, this is standard textbook theory as we know it, that to get more power, you go faster.
Yeah.
Okay? But what I won't go into right now is this generator doesn't make any difference what speed that it's spinning. In fact, it has to come to a dead stop before it puts out, before it quits putting out its power. And yes, it is backwards to the load.
Is this generator a common type of machine that can be purchased or built?
Well, it cannot be purchased, okay?
Yeah.
Many have tried to build it with unsuccessful results because they can't get away from their common training, okay?
Right.
Look, it's the law of the land right now that the textbook is right, okay?
Yeah, I don't believe that.
Well,
but anyhow, you can get a hold of John's paper if you want to. And
or the tape, yeah.
Has the whole thing. It's available through the Tesla Book Company at 1580 Magnolia in Millbrae, California, 94030.
Yeah.
And Tom's papers are available there, and you're making that tape available?
Yeah.
Just send your name and address to me, and I'll get to John, and he'll get back to you.
All right, fine. Because I'd like to, I have a...
It's a very unusual tape. It's 2 hours.
Is it VHS?
I mean, yes, it's VHS only.
Okay, very good. I would like to, is it something that can, on a loan basis, or is it something you buy, or what?
No, it's something that you purchase, and it's yours for all eternity.
Sounds good.
Okay, Glenn?
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And I will, shall I write to you there at KABC?
Yeah, just write to me here at the radio station, right?
All right, fine. Thank you.
Gotcha. And I think we have one of your neighbors on the line here, John. Ivan, welcome aboard.
Good evening, Bill. It's nice to talk to a neighbor, John. I'm one of your other free energy people up here in Fillmore.
With that great big windmill sticking
up in
your
backyard. I've got the 42-foot high, 8-foot in diameter wind turbine. And talking about the free energy. Have you devised a battery system that can store the energy that you make? Because I'm interested in storage capacities also.
Now, let me ask you one question first. I've driven down the freeway many times and looked at that windmill up there, okay?
Uh-huh.
Wind turbine.
When does it ever turn?
Okay, well, you don't really observe it turning from the outside because the outside fins don't really turn. They direct the air into the into the bucket. So when the wind is blowing, you'll see it turning.
Well, yeah. I watched it spin one day. It was quite curious to me. Yes, you can store this energy in batteries and use it for future use.
Okay, I just wondered if you had developed any kind of stick or battery that might be applicable here.
Well, I don't want to go into a lot of things on batteries, but yes, I have been working on one type of particular battery with a very special kind of electrolyte that is more like a, it's not even an acid, okay, it's an earth, let's put it that way. And yes, I have been filtering and looking at some things, and I found out that the type of battery that probably is going to have to be developed for this would be crystallar type. In other words, we paste our plates right now. But this sort of would be like a pocket battery, okay, as if the plates had pockets instead of grids, all right? And it's been something that I've been working on, and I can't really go into all the details on it. It would take hours and hours. But, yes, it would take a very high... in other words, these machines seem to be producing in the X-ray region. They react funny with Geiger counters. They make the needle move. Every once in a while I've noticed that the machine's output varies with the month. In other words, depending on what the fields are, which is not surprising to Tom or many other people out there, but yes, there are times that the machine varies its own output because the batteries have been constant. You see, I haven't been able to find what you'd call a magnet that can take this shorting effect yet. In other words, a constant short effect. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
The generator, I think you would find if you put one of these generators up in the wind that you would need probably 2 55-gallon trash cans in place of your big generator, and it would probably put out, you know, much more than what that turbine is.
Simon, hello, what are you doing up this late?
Hi there, Bob, how are you tonight?
Just great. Way back in the beginning, the late 70s, the folks out at Solar World observed the same phenomena that at certain times of the month, their generators, apparently at the same RPM, were putting out varying amounts of power. You remember those?
That's interesting.
Yeah, and we were looking at the way that those fields were wound. Ivan has one of the Solar World, and we're back to the hooker.
I was wondering, you're right.
Yes, exactly.
Right.
Yeah. And there have been a couple of burnouts of those that have just totally melted down.
Unexplained.
Right, and we're back to scalar again. And
now, see, Bob, you know, now that you mention this, me and Steve, will verify this. Now, we're talking about coils that are wound with number 18-gauge wire and number 14-gauge wire. Me and Steve had a burnout of four coils all at one time. Absolute, absolute dead shorts to the pole pieces, including the field coils. And I think Steve can tell you there was no way possible.
I know. This is one of the biggest mysteries, at least in my young life.
But one question I do have, Bob and me, and I guess it's Ivan?
Yes.
Did you ever notice the no drag effect with this type of generator? In other words, do you notice drag on this type of turbine when it's putting out power?
Well, the alternator in this uses a particular type of non-ferrous magnets through Paul Winchell and so forth, and they eliminate about 80% of your eddy current, so...
Yes.
You don't have the drag that you do with a regular ferrous type motor.
Okay, but do you notice a type of acceleration under load?
I don't think the folks out at Solar World have seen that.
No, I'm just very curious, see, because the type generators which we're working on, as you load them, they accelerate. They go faster under load. You see, this is why I said that probably, like I was claiming, you could probably get away generating this 1 kilowatt with a 2-foot propeller, or maybe one squirrel cage.
There's a similar phenomenon in the old DC motors that were shunt wound. When you decrease the energy to the shunt field, the motor has to speed up to conserve the energy. That's well known in the old streetcar engineering days.
Ivan, just for a moment while you have you on the phone, how is your wind turbine doing out there? Is it satisfactory to you?
Okay, we haven't had the Santa Ana wind conditions yet that will really put out a lot of energy. I have noticed a small decrease in my electric bill. Of course, I don't have gas anymore. The gas company took my meter out 2-3 years ago, so... It will take a year, probably, and I didn't get officially hooked up with the Department of Water and Power until June the 14th. So,
in your case, whenever you produce more energy than you're using, you're required to sell it to the Department of Water and Power, right?
Right. It goes back on their line. I sell it to them at wholesale, and, of course, when I buy it at retail. So that's why the batteries are...
Isn't there a compromise available, Ivan?
In a case like John, yours produces electricity on demand.
Yes,
so.
You see, I'm very interested in seeing if one of these generators can be put into operation with a squirrel cage or a 2-foot propeller. I've, you know, been looking at this because I think it's possible at very, very low RPM that we could produce the same amount of power that we would at 10,000 RPMs.
Come by and look at my unit sometime, John.
I've driven by, but that's like Fort Knox over there, so I can go up to the door. I've considered of getting, you know, I mean, it's a beautiful house and everything, and don't get me wrong, but you kind of wonder, you know, you see all those bars and everything. I wonder if I'm going to get shot if I ever walk up to the door.
Well, just go ahead. Those dogs aren't that actually vicious. Bob, I noticed in today's Spotlight that there was an article about multi-wave oscillators, and thought maybe you might want to make some comment about the latest development and maybe an electromagnetic.
For me, Ivan, I never quite got around to subscribing. What I would like to say is that it's not all bad news. I was the guest of the Arceus Project in Minneapolis a few weeks ago. I had a whole day with Otto Schmidt, the grand old man of magnetics. He is convinced that he has frequencies which will rejuvenate brain tissue. And a lot of this is scalar. His older brother, Francis O. Schmidt, is professor of neurobiology at MIT. And he came out here and spent a day or two with me last month. And I am convinced that the future of medicine is going to be in the scalar electromagnetic domain, that we're going to be eventually out from under the thumb of the pharmaceutical houses. So it's not all weaponry. I think this will be one of the saving graces. A thing which did come up is that when this technology is available, it will disrupt Social Security, pension funds, and what have you, because we'll be rejuvenating some of the geriatric patients. Now, this is real. I mean, this is an outgrowth of the work of Robert O. Becker, who is growing arms and legs back on higher life forms and was sort of horizontally arabesqued out of the Veterans Administration, where he was chief of orthopedic surgery. But we're looking forward to some brand new things in this whole domain. And they're not all weapons.
Not at all.
They'll make life a lot better for
us. Well, that's the beauty of the technology. There's
right.
Although the weapons always seem to be the way it gets funded.
Can medical applications are formidable.
Yes, they are.
Bill, yeah. Can I say one thing to Ivan before he goes?
Sure.
I'll stop by and see you, Ivan. Just
okay.
Give me a good day.
Okay.
Name the day.
Tom, before they give us that quiz at the end of the hour, maybe you could make some real fast comparison between quirks and the particles that are in the vacuum.
Quarks? Oh, quarks, you mean?
Uh-huh.
Well, a quark is just a fractional charge. In the theory that they use, they come out with, I think it's six kinds now, and I think they found evidence for all six. There's one anomaly in fractional charges. There's one group at Stanford that keeps getting fractional charges on niobium balls, and nobody else seems to be able to replicate it. The only other thing I can throw in the older literature, a fellow by the name of Aaron Half regularly reported getting fractional charges, and he could even control the amount of the fraction. And as far as I know, nobody's really gone back and tried to duplicate Aaron Half's work.
Oh, and they have that mine shaft that's real deep that they've been running all the equipment in trying to record this. I thought that there might have been something new in that field.
Well, they still didn't get, as far as I know, they still haven't got enough neutrinos out of the sun. They're about to change their mind about what's going on inside the sun.
Huge tanks of perchlorate.
Okay, Ivan, congratulations on that stab that you made, that effort that's gone on out there and with your wind turbine. And John Bedini and you two should get together. You don't live that far apart from each other.
About less than one mile. I think you could walk to my house.
Be happy to see you, John.
Okay.
I'm usually here on weekends, Friday, Saturday, or Sunday.
I'm the only guy on my block with a windmill in the back that's been powering the garage all this time off a 12-volt battery bank. Yeah, but I've had good wind up there lately, to where I've put out a lot of amp hours with this generator, and I put out more this year than I've been able to use up.
Well, okay, well, we'll look forward to seeing you.
Okay, David. Thank you very much.
Okay, good night now.
And we're just about out of time, it's here. Rather than get into another call, and John, Lori, Bill, Richard are all on the line, we just won't have a chance to get to them, and they missed the quiz tonight.
Fastest 3 hours in radio.
Oh, listen to you. I want to thank all of you for dropping in on us here tonight. Tom Bearden flying all the way in from Huntsville, Alabama, and give a chance to see the man that has thrilled us for so long. And I hope you're not ready to go to bed, because we're going to continue this show all night long, but it'll be kind of in private, and I'm sorry the rest of you can't join along. And John Bedini, thank you very much, and Steve Wirth for coming down, and congratulations on that ongoing effort that you're doing, and yes,
that free energy device is in your future. And Dr. Bob Beck, what do we say to you? The man who's done it all and is continuing to do it all, on top of it all. Thank you all for coming down. I'll see you next week. Liz McAdams will be here.